Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. We cast our gaze abroad today, to Brazil and then Iran. Alex Hukeli will explore what people mean by Brazilianization, and Neda Borlucci will look at the upcoming presidential election in Iran. People often speak of the Brazilianization of various countries, including the U.S., or indeed of the entire world under neoliberalism, featuring massive polarization, political corruption, and the weakening of state competence. Alex Hukeli has an interesting article on the topic in American Affairs. I must say I have some reservations about American Affairs. It looks to be a fundamentally right-wing project trying to make some friends on the left. It was founded by a former hedge fund guy and Trump fan, and is partly funded by the Hewlett Foundation's After Neoliberalism project. That said, it does publish some interesting articles, and this is one of them. Alex Hukeli, who is based in Sao Paulo, is a host of the Auf Hebunga Bunga podcast, and is the co-author, along with George Hoare and Philip Cunliffe, of The End of the End of History, forthcoming from Zero Books. Here he is to explain the phenomenon from the point of view of someone based there, Alex Hukeli. We frequently speak of the Brazilianization of many things. United States, we talk about it here. Other countries talk about it. The world in general. What precisely do we mean when we talk about the Brazilianization of X?
Well, the first thing to note is a sense beyond just the title Brazilianization. It's a sense that politics in the rich world is increasingly chaotic, disorganized. It doesn't fit the patterns that we have been used to since the end of the Second World War, or even really since the end of the Cold War. Not just that, but in social terms, growing inequality, the dualization of cities such that the urban cores become increasingly gentrified with the poor pushed out to the outskirts, and maybe even a broader sense of stagnation and of irresolution, the sense or drift maybe, the sense that politics isn't able to really advance, to get beyond this situation that we see elites as corrupt, but we're not able to really do anything about it. And so there's just a broader sense of being stuck and even of social degradation. And that, I think, is why the label Brazilianization applies, though it goes beyond that. And there are specific reasons why Brazil is chosen as the kind of avatar of the West, the developed West's future, and not, say, Mexico or South Africa or whatever other country you care to pick.
Yeah, I want to go into that some more, but at least since the early 1960s, people have been speaking of Brazil as the country of the future. Brazil's future seems to be just this moving target that keeps moving ahead. But what about that lie that it's the country of the future? How does that play in Brazil? Do people still talk about that? What does it mean exactly?
People talk about it, but really only ironically these days. But I think that the thing is that Brazil has gone through many patterns of great expectation and then deflation. And I think if you take the kind of high modernist period of the end of the 50s and the early 60s, Brazil was kind of the wave of growth was cresting. I mean, Brazil had seen some of the highest growth rates in the world for a number of decades. There were great expectations that Brazil had this really serious modernist spirit of developing the interior. You had the building of Brasilia, this great modernist capital in the interior, and a sense that Brazil would at some point claim its destiny as a great country, that it had such a great natural bounty, that it had this big population, that it had this maybe even a different sense of its civilization, which was different to what you had in the United States, which I guess is a comparable country in terms of size, history of slavery, and so on. But that sense of a future that never came weighs, I think, on Brazilian consciousness. There is a sense that Brazil has all these great possibilities. But as I put it in the piece, Brazil is not held down by the fact that it's unable to reach its promise, to fulfill its promise. But the fact of its frustration is the very essence, in some sense, of Brazil, insofar as we can speak of national essences.
Brazil has, of course, this history of giant land holdings, a landholding elite. How does that heritage still linger in Brazil today?
I mean, you can see it politically in terms of political bosses at state level, but also who are in Congress, that it's all the old families, basically. And you can look at, grab a random senator and look at their surname and you go, oh, well, yeah, you know, their father and their grandfather was also a senator and so on. And you can trace their lineage back to, you know, being large landholders in the more poor rural Northeast, but not only there, really across the country. that mode of doing politics, which isn't ideological, which is purely based on rent-seeking, on being recipients of pork, plays out politically. Brazil has something like 35 parties. I think it has 28 in Congress now. It's a hugely fragmented system. And most of those parties aren't ideological in any proper sense. They're just vehicles for the ruling class to pursue its interests. And its interests aren't in any sense developmentalist. I mean, they're very much just very short-term, immediate interests in terms of getting their share of the federal budget. And I think that's one way in which you can see a continuity between this mold of old-style politics, something that we would almost understand as sort of semi-feudal, with a qualification that it was never really semi-feudal. Brazil was always modern. It was always a site for colonial extraction. But the point being is that we can trace a lineage between these old landholders and that old form of politics, of patrimonialist politics, where everything happens within the household, where they have servants inside the household and so on. That mode of politics in some way gets translated or parlayed into contemporary Brazilian politics. And Brazil is a fully modern country, and yet this form of politics is something that doesn't really fit our model of universalizing politics based on the competition between socialism and capitalism, or between, you know, Christian democracy and workers' parties and so on. A huge swathe of the political class just doesn't fit into that ideological polarization in the way that we have come to understand it in Western Europe and North America.
Now, I would think that a landed elite would resist industrialization because it would threaten to overturn the social hierarchy that they sat on top of. How has that played out over the years?
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's been a major factor. They were opposed to it. But what's interesting is that a key pivot moment, and I already mentioned 1964 and the coup, which is a great example there as well, where you had the working class rising, you had a growing industrial proletariat, which was gaining more power and would have required, though, for a new sort of settlement for the national bourgeoisie, and not just the old landed elites, or not particularly the old landed elites, but even industrialists, to in some way ally with them to come to a new settlement where the masses were more integrated, the state promised greater services, greater social citizenship, and so on. That never happened because the national bourgeoisie itself, even the industrialists, preferred domination of the working classes and the poor instead of actually integrating them as they might have done, which would have led perhaps to a wealthier and more powerful Brazil, actually, because it would have allowed for a greater development, a larger internal market and so on. And what happened instead is that they preferred to remain dependent on the United States, dependent on internal markets, and never was able to kind of gather the sense of or eke out a bit more national autonomy for even for Brazilian elites in a way that, for example, you could see the Chinese doing now.
Some of what you say about Brazil reminds me of the American South, the concentrated land holdings, an elite that's interested in retarding industrial development, and of course, the heritage of slavery. Is that comparison made in Brazil often?
It's sometimes made in Brazil. Yeah, it is. And I think I think when people talk, especially about the northeast of Brazil, which is the poorest area, which has become a bit of a stronghold of the Workers' Party in the past 15 years, there's more obvious correlates with the American South. So yeah, no, it is an example which isn't completely missed. But I think the point is that you never had these big ruptures that the United States had. You neither had the American Revolution, you know, of independence, a war of independence, as the United States did. In fact, you have this continuity between the Portuguese Empire. The Portuguese crown even moves to Brazil and after the Napoleonic Wars. You don't have these clear breaks where a new order is formed. Instead, you kind of slowly slouch into the new, bringing a bit of the old with you. And then that happened also because there was no civil war. Brazil was also the last country in the Western Hemisphere to abolish slavery. It's tempting to make that comparison with the United States, but the United States does have these revolutionary moments, which Brazil doesn't have.
You write some about Cardoso, Fernando Henrique Cardoso, a sociologist who was on the left in the 60s who became a neoliberal president of Brazil in the 90s. You make the point that he thought, against prevailing left opinion in the 60s, that the Brazilian bourgeoisie would prefer being a junior partner to the West rather than being big fish on its own. How has that played out over time?
The point is not mine originally, but it's something that I use in the article because I think it's a great little irony. Because, I mean, it's already, as I described, that the national bourgeoisie could not be relied upon in the view of Fernando Henrique Cardoso, and it's something that he was proved right about, that they would again prefer domestic domination over the lower classes instead of being able to create some sort of, I guess you would call it a sort of populist alliance leading to, in a sort of nationalist guise and a sort of nationalist populist arrangement, which might lead to greater growth, later incorporation of the masses, and greater autonomy for Brazil as a state. But I think this is something that plays out even, to take a much more recent example, with the PT governments, the Workers' Party's governments under Lula and then under Dilma, because, and particularly under Dilma, who of course was impeached in 2016 under very flimsy grounds, off the back of a huge wave of discontent with her government, but which the leadership of which was big capital, the big media, and so on. And that was another case in which, in much more restricted forms, that the Workers' Party tried to incorporate the masses, albeit in a very limited way of basically allowing people greater spending power in the market, but not really transforming the state or even really leading to a huge improvement in public services. But they nevertheless, it was based on an alliance between the Workers' Party and the national bourgeoisie, especially big construction companies. And of course, as soon as things turned a little bit sour, they all turned on the Workers' Party and kicked them out of office, and they all supported the impeachment. And so that was another way, I think, in which I guess the irony of Fernando Henrique Cardoso's predictions or analysis from the 1960s actually ended up playing out once again in Brazil, in contemporary Brazil.
Someone told me that one of the reasons that the Brazilian upper classes, or even to the upper middle classes, really hated Lula with a passion was that he encouraged their maids to be rude to them. First of all, do you think there's any truth to that? But second, you write in your piece about the availability of a very cheap labor supply so that people can have servants to a degree not seen in most other countries of the world. But this is something that's becoming a feature of the outside world, part of the Brazilianization of everything. So could you talk about the servant class in Brazil? So,
yeah, absolutely. I think the point is that it's not just the wealthy who have domestic servants. I mean, middle class will have cleaners, might maybe not live in cleaners, but will have access to cleaners in a way that was, maybe not still is, but was looked upon as completely disreputable amongst the middle classes of Western Europe, for example, over the course of the latter half of the 20th century. Maybe that's now changing, as you indicate. But the fact is that with such low cost of labor, if you're middle class, you aren't really in the middle or even in the, maybe, let's say, like the 60th percentile or 70th percentile, but you fly over the social gap effectively. And it means that you have a cheap labor to make use of. And it means that it guarantees you a greater standard of living than the Brazilian equivalents would have in the United States, for example, who don't have access to as cheap labor, and certainly as in comparison to Western Europe, where labor rights have been stronger. That's something that which is very evident, and it is something that was regularized. So domestic workers were regularized under the Lula government, and they were granted rights and had be made to pay overtime and so on. And of course, the upper middle classes hated that because that seemed to make a big dent in their own living standards or their own status, their ability effectively to make use of all this cheap labor. But as I point out in the article, this is something that seems to be growing in the West. You know, I talk about the whole host of concierge services, which are now available, of private yoga teachers, private chefs, and so on, which you can now access through your app. And, you know, all the kind of platform services seem to be just a battering ram against labor rights rather than necessarily being profitable businesses in their own right. But nevertheless, the effect of it all is that now even middle class people can take. I mean, I think, I noticed it myself. I would never have been able to afford a taxi before, or, you know, only in like some special occasion or in case of an emergency. Whereas now, you know, you can take Ubers all the time. And I think that's a good example. And the political effect of this is important, because what's happened in Brazil is that if you have access to drivers, for example, as the upper middle class has had, you don't need to care about investment in public transport. In fact, why would you want investment in public transport? You're fine with your private driver. And in some ways, the Brazilianization of the world is also a story here, where you don't need to invest in public services if you have Ubers, and Ubers are relatively cheap, and therefore you can just use that instead of really caring that the bus only comes once every half hour or that there's no new metro lines or whatever it might be.
I'm speaking with the researcher and writer Alex Hokely. Brazil has Bolsonaro. We had Trump. These kinds of figures are spreading around the world. I imagine this is part of the Brazilianization of the rest of the world we're talking about. How did Bolsonaro, a figure like him, emerge from this kind of Brazil you're talking about?
the Bolsonaro story can't be understood as a flash in the pan, or maybe something that, like, is a thunderstorm on a clear day, or whatever metaphor you want to use. I always make the point that you need to look at Brazil since 2013. And 2013 was a breaking point, I think, or a big turning point in Brazil, because what happened is that after 12 years of Workers' Party government, which was very stable, saw reasonable growth on the back of the commodities super cycle, a sense of growing inclusion for the masses. They massively expanded private universities and gave bursaries to people for that. So, you know, children of the working class, or at least some, were able to go to university for the first time in family history. So there was that sense of advance, and yet it still led to this huge amount of frustration, the sense that things weren't getting better. And you can look across the world, and often when there are big protests, riots, uprisings, maybe not riots, but, big uprisings, there are moments of actually that come at the end of rising expectations rather than things just getting worse. And that's what happened in 2013. And it was really a revolt of the young precariat who suddenly felt like, no, enough. We still have too much corruption. We still have public services which haven't kept pace with growth in personal incomes. And that's enough. You know, we were sick of the cynicism or the sense of just social passivity, which had grown over the course of the Workers' Party in government, which, you know, itself was responsible for having demobilized its base. So what was once a very vibrant, exciting political party had become increasingly bureaucratized over its period in government. But so to jump forward, you had this huge protest. And what happened was that after that, it began to mutate, and it became increasingly focused on anti-corruption. It, even during protests, banned all party flags, party insignia, and so on, and became directly what I call anti-political, and became a widespread rejection of the political establishment, of the political class as a whole.
Now, are these anything like, you know, these cyber parties we've seen and the pirate parties we've seen elsewhere in the world?
Those are facets of the same thing. Yeah, absolutely. That rejection of the old political establishment and a sense that normal democratic parliamentary representation isn't enough, or maybe is just bad. And that latter thing is more problematic, because if you're saying, no, get rid of the lot of them, but we want to take power, right? We, our political party or our organization or our movement, are coalescing into a single thing, and we're going to take power. We're going to rule society and transform it. That's great. But what happens if you're saying, well, nothing, if it's the movement itself is completely fragmented and all that unifies it is just rejection of the political establishment, and maybe even rejection in the belief that anything can really get better, but it's just a denunciation of the powers that be? That's problematic, because what that creates is a huge vacuum, a huge kind of legitimacy vacuum, which is what happened to the Brazilian political class and what allowed Bolsonaro to waltz in and portray himself as an outsider, as non-corrupt and anti-corrupt, which is, of course, completely farcical, because he had been a seven-term congressman for a long period of that in the PP, a party which is traces its roots back to the military dictatorship, one of the most corrupt, old, patrimonialist, clientelistic parties in Congress, right? A real disgusting grouping of people. And he came from that. For all his talk of, I'm going to reject the old politics and I'm in favor of the new politics, I'm not going to do the old horse trading in Parliament, in Congress, I'm going to just rule directly, he is an exemplar. He's an avatar of that old elite in many ways. Maybe not in his personal background, because he was a middle-ranking officer and not an old elite, but nevertheless, he is an avatar of the old politics, at least as Congress is concerned. But it was that movement, that anti-political movement, coupled with the massive anti-corruption investigations called Lava Jato, which played a big part also in delegitimizing the whole political system, that created this void in which Bolsonaro could step into as a sort of white knight, uncorrupt, and so on.
Well, of course, now COVID, total disaster in Brazil. Bolsonaro can't by any measure be described as a success. So where does this leave the country, and what portent does it hold for the rest of the world that may be experiencing its own Brazilianization?
To kind of add on, to tack on to my previous answer, is that sort of delegitimation of the political class is something we're seeing across the world, especially across the West, to varying degrees in different countries. But we can see Trump as an avatar of that. We can see Brexit absolutely as that. We can see the Gilets Jaunes in France as an example of that. Whereas before, you know, throughout the 1990s and 2000s, people were slowly falling out of politics. They were no longer members of political parties. They were voting less and less, and so on. At the end of history, as I like to call it, as of, let's say, 2016, you see in some ways an acceleration of that process. and no longer any sense of passivity, which was happening before. People slowly falling out of politics, suddenly people are getting angry and going to the streets and saying, no, that's enough. Now, with respect to Bolsonaro and the lack of the lack of success, which is to put it far, far too mildly, there's a great sense of exhaustion in Brazil, a sense that all these hopes, and again, I mean, it's this cycle again of great hopes, expectations, things, the sense of things are finally getting better, either through the Workers' Party in government over the 2000s, or because of the 2013 protests and what came after, that suddenly Brazil is going to be cleaned up from corruption, that the giant has awoken, as the slogan was on the streets, that the people have awoken, and now we're going to take charge. Now we're no longer going to be passive recipients of politics, but active agents. Even that now has sort of come to an end. And once again, Brazil is faced with these memories of a sense of an uprising, of things maybe getting better, and then facing this pathetic denouement again. You know, not even a clear rupture, but just a nasty sort of compromise. And even the impeachment of Dilma Rousseff, which the left referred to as a coup, I mean, I would refer to it as a soft coup or a parliamentary coup, even then isn't a decisive break. Things get kind of smoothed over. And so you have this democratic election in 2018 where Bolsonaro gets elected. And so you think, well, that looks like a return to democracy because it followed the usual democratic procedures and, you know, et cetera, free and fair elections and whatnot. But in many ways, that ends up being the kind of consummation of the elite-led soft coup of 2016. After all this, there's just a sense of exhaustion, I think. There's been so much political turbulence, very, very deep economic crisis, huge unemployment, and even the official figures mask the true reality of it because there's a huge degree of informality, people falling out of the formal workforce. Indeed, lots of the labor rights associated with formal employment have been completely cut. So, for example, there's been a right to infinite outsourcing, even of a company's core services. So this sort of precaritization is continuing apace. So people are exhausted. What has changed and what happened last week, which is heartening at least, is that you had big protests all around the country against Bolsonaro, denouncing Bolsonaro as a genocidaire, calling for his impeachment and so on. I don't think he's going to be impeached because there's too many interests in not seeing him impeached, including from the Workers' Party, who would rather let him bleed there than impeach him. And so there's lots of calculations going on there in Congress. I don't think he'll be impeached. Most of the political class would be happy to wait it out, let him bleed, and then see him defeated in the polls in 2012. Excuse me, 2022. There's a sense of rising against Bolsonaro, but the problem is that there's a complete lack of an alternative. And we're in many ways in a worse situation than we were, you know, a decade ago, because the alternative is Lula and the return of Lula. And as much as I think that would be I'm not a lesser evil guy, and I've never been, but this is one case where I am absolutely a lesser evil guy because Bolsonaro is so destructive of the state, of state capacities, of the basic running of the state, as well as such a threat to democracy that I think, you know, I would support Lula. But the problem with Lula is that it's only returned to a status quo ante, which was very unsatisfactory already before. And what the Lula proposition is, we're going to go back to stable management. I'm going to like run the economy in a sensible fashion. I'm going to ally with different groups across the political spectrum. This is not going to be the left in power by any means. So Brazil is faced, at least in the polls next year, with a choice between terminal decline or a death spiral. And I'll go for terminal decline. Thank you very much.
Yes. I look at the American scene and I see a capitalist class here that is really unlike that of the 19th and much of the 20th century, which was interested in building stuff. Brutally, often destructively, but still interested in building stuff. I see a capitalist class that really is mostly about asset stripping and looting at this point. And it sounds like you could say something similar to the Brazilian bourgeoisie, and we're seeing a lot of this around the world. Is there a way out of this cycle of destruction, or is this climate disaster and despair is what we just have to have as our future, inevitable future?
So I'm making a big effort here to try to be positive and optimistic because, I know, but you know, my essay is pretty gloomy, but I think at least we can take a positive from the negatives, let's put it that way, that the falling apart of the neoliberal order offers at least some space. And I think what we're seeing now is the political class responding in some sense to all the populist uprisings that you've had over a decade. You know, the 2010s was the populist decade, and especially in Europe, but not just. It's, I think, more in response to that than in response to anything the left has done. But states are having to respond with actually spending. You know, you see it in the UK with the Johnson government, which arguably now is no more to the right than the Labour Party is, I think, which is talking about increased state spending, trying to smooth out regional inequalities, talking about guaranteeing jobs and so on. Now, I'm not saying we should be satisfied with that, but it does offer a vision where the state transforms from being something which is like, well, yep, we're washing our hands, you're completely on your own, we're just going to asset strip and accumulate, you know, kind of through financial means, to one where the state takes more direct responsibility for social outcomes. Why is that good? I mean, it doesn't mean that we should be happy with that. And I don't think, you know, a turn away from neoliberal austerity is necessarily the promised land. Anti-austerity politics is very limited, because what we're going to get now is an end to austerity, maybe, but nothing that great. But Where's the cause for optimism? Firstly, that the state taking direct responsibility means that it can be held to account for what it does and doesn't do. When the state completely washes its hands of politics, it's very difficult to challenge them, because they say, well, you know, this was the central bank which decided interest rates, nothing to do with us. This was a quango which is responsible for regulating such and such, nothing to do with us. If legislators and especially the executive start saying we're going to do such and such and we're taking direct responsibility for it, then that at least offers us a capacity to hold them to account. And I think that's positive. And the other thing that I would highlight is just with the pandemic, that the discourse of essential workers, you know, has upended the existing hierarchy of labor, where, you know, it was previously consultants and CEOs and financiers who were the essential workers without which the economy couldn't run. Now, at least we've been reminded that it's train drivers and nurses and cleaners and so on who make society run. And that's important, something that I hope we hold on to.
That is Alex Hoakley, author of The Brazilianization of the World, published in the American Affairs website. He is the co-author, along with George Hoare and Philip Cunliffe, of The End of the End of History, forthcoming from Zero Books. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Some of Deerhoof doing Lilliput's Hitchhike from the Kill Rock Star's 30th birthday self-celebration, which consists of contemporary covers of KRS classics. They're releasing them throughout the year, and this one's just out. Next, Iran. That country has a presidential election coming up on June 18th. It's a political system like no other. To get on the ballot, prospective candidates have to be approved by a guardian council, which consists of a dozen clerics and religious lawyers. Troublemakers will not get approved. And the elected president is not actually the chief executive authority in the country. That distinction belongs to a supreme leader, a cleric, currently Ali Khamenei, who's been in that office since 1989. Is this presidential election actually an audition for who will succeed Khamenei, who recently celebrated his 82nd birthday as overboss? The odds-on favorite to win is the conservative Chief Justice Ibrahim Raisi. Here with more is Neda Bulurchi, an assistant professor of Middle Eastern Studies at Rutgers. Iran has an election coming up. It's a strange kind of democracy. It's certainly a more democratic country than Saudi Arabia, but it's also a very constricted kind of democracy. Could you describe just generally the procedures for selecting candidates in Iran, which are not typical of procedures found elsewhere in the world.
Generally, what happens is there is either a self-selection process whereby a person decides that they themselves want to run for president, and they fill out the forms and they submit those forms by the due deadline, or you're part of a political party that puts forward your name with your tacit approval. And so these are generally two of the ways that happens. For the most part, it is sort of this self-nomination process. And so you end up anywhere from hundreds of people, as you did this year, I think just shy of 600, to sometimes in the thousands. Then there is this body called the Guardian Council that goes through the forms, and they then whittle down the hundreds or thousands down to under 10 people. And the Guardian Council has their own parameters of what constitutes an eligible candidate. And it's usually somebody who has not expressed dissent with the idea of the existing system, i.e. the Islamic Republic as it exists, or the idea of velayat-e faqih, which is guidance by the jurisprudent. And that means that there is a supreme leader who is a cleric. And then there are other qualifications that the Guardian Council looks for, but they generally have not been explicit. It's around, are you religiously pious and are you an adherent of the system? No woman has, despite the fact that women have repeatedly nominated themselves and been nominated, no woman has been accepted.
Within these bounds of acceptability, there is certainly something of a spectrum, right? What are the bounds of permissible political opinion for this Guardian Council?
The permissible bounds have been really, are you deemed to be religiously pious? What kind of religious person are you? The system itself, the Islamic Republic, necessitates your believing in religion, and particularly the idea that a cleric is in a good, and clerics generally are in a position to guide a country. And so that's one. The other, and which we see more stringently being applied this year, and that they've specifically added, is this idea of executive leadership. And so that you had to have previously an executive leadership role. You can't be a novice, that you must have been involved in government at a high level before. Also added this year was age parameters. The specific age parameters are 40 to 75. And so these are the parameters. And like I said, and that you cannot have expressed some sort of dissent. So this would have been somebody who would be disqualified probably for dissent is Ahmadinejad, the former president himself, who has since leaving office more than 8 years ago, has expressed statements of sort of dissent or interpreted as dissent, as well as from other what we'll call eccentric ideas for at least Iran, that would be seen as curious, if not possibly giving a rise to questions about security, right? And anything that might what generally classifies as the red lines, right? Anybody who has said or done something that might be considered suspicious.
Just this morning, I was reading a piece in the Financial Times about this forthcoming election, and they throw in these terms which are common in Western coverage of Iran: hardliners, centrists, reformists. Do these terms mean all that much, or are they figments of the Western imagination?
They're just sort of these easy catchphrases for the West, where most people don't really follow the specifics or the details of what's happening in Iran. So it's easy to classify categories of political actors in these groups. So the quintessential sort of reformist is former President Khatami, who is known more for trying to reestablish ties with the United States, his discourse on civilization and being civilized, and sort of his support of what ended up being the 2009 Green Movement. The other end of that as a conservative would be former President Ahmadinejad, who, if people don't know, has taken to Twitter and who has expressed concerns about equality and discrimination and bias in the U.S. and Europe. He has generally been classified on the conservative side, even though he is very much a populist and during his presidency did buildings for low-income populations, handed direct payments to low-income populations. He has been classified as a conservative, and he is kind of a conservative in the sense that he is a security conservative. He comes from the Revolutionary Guard. He does have conservative tenets about gender norms and the place of people in society, but he is not the full conservative that we are seeing clearly with the candidates that are running right now, particularly Ibrahim Raisi. And then your centrists, Doug, are more those like former president who has passed, Rafsanjani, who's is dead now, but his sort of protege, who's the current president, Rouhani, is much more of a centrist pragmatist. So these are the politicians that we can kind of easily put as figureheads for these three groupings.
But there's just simply no permissible challenge to a theocratic regime.
No. And particularly that's been sort of the very clear message that has been sent since 2009, where you have in the aftermath of the riots and the revolts over Ahmadinejad's election or re-election, you have those leaders under Mousavi and Kerubi under house arrest. Khatami's image, because of his support to them, his image can't be seen. I'm not sure if his voice is even allowed still to be heard. This wasn't that they were against the system, to be clear. It's that they were saying that the system had gone astray and that it wasn't engaged in the limited type of republicanism that is proffered by the Constitution. And so I want to be clear about that. It's not that 2009 was against the system. It was against the hijacking of the republican form of the system as it is in the Constitution.
What were the effects of Trump pulling out of the arms deal?
Quite huge. We can see the maximum pressure policy, despite its significant failure, as being the catalyst very much for Iran moving east. Because the U.S. under Trump, and that's it's a bipartisan measure that continues now, didn't do anything about the sanctions levied against Iran. It gave evidence to all of the Iranian conservatives saying, you can't trust the United States. The Europeans are impotent. Nobody is going to do anything. And why should we bother? Part of this is that the reformists tend to want to go westward. And I don't even just mean that sociopolitically. I mean that in economic terms. They believe in the technology and the creativity that can happen when engaged with Western companies and governments. The conservatives and the ultra-conservatives disagree with that, and they think that there's nothing wrong with, and in fact, it's better for Iran to go eastward. And so when you had the Trump administration come in and withdraw from the JCPOA, and then the subsequent 4 years of no one and no institution doing anything about it, it gave proof and evidence to those conservatives and ultra-conservatives, including Iran's leader, Khamenei, that, see, you were wrong, I was right. And in the grand strategy that was being developed, it gave the boost to shift, which was happening and it was underway. To be clear, there was this very large Eastern shift in movement, at least I think since 2004, but there was still some disagreement about it. And the JCPOA very much was hinged on not just sanctions relief, but about who was credible in the world and who Iran could work with. And the idea that it could work with, because of its geographic location, it could work with a range of actors. And the Trump administration's policies and the repercussions of it clearly took care of that. And so the eastward trend and desire by Khamenei clearly has won out.
By eastward, you mean what, Russia or what else?
Well, Russia, but more China. And this was really visible even before we got to the announcement or even the precursory sort of ideas of the 25-year deal with China. Everyone wants to talk about geography. If you look at the Belt Road Initiative and you understand or understood that Iran and China had been doing deals, clearly when Xi Jinping undertakes and pronounces a new Belt Road Initiative, you could see Iran saying, well, let us partake in this. This is a good economic deal for us to be part of, too. It's a good transportation deal. But it's also going to encompass military, have a military impact. The response to that 25-year deal is that it's more fanfare than reality. I don't think so. both governments do not release enough information or data. And also, a lot of those people making those announcements are not inside of Iran to see exactly the commercial happenings, the flood of products coming in and the outflows from Iran going out. Just because they don't end up on ledgers does not mean that they're not happening. There are sort of alternatives to official ledgers. And I would hasten to, you know, remind people of that.
I'm speaking with the Middle Eastern studies scholar Neda Borlucci. The FT says that Raisi, the hardliner, is likely to win easily. Is that your view too?
Absolutely. I think it's several weeks in now that he was the front runner. The reformists and even the centrists have been apathetic going into this because they have known for at least a year that there would be low voter turnout based on the elections last year, coupled with the fact that the population, the Iranian population, is very mad about the lack of sanctions relief and sort of the decimation of the Iranian economy, as well as the horrific ramifications and impact of COVID-19 on Iran. It is and remains to be one of the COVID hotspots. The expected turn towards conservatism has been anticipated for at least a year and a half in Iran. And so that's why you did not see any big centrist or reformist names. The fact that the Biden administration was slow to get involved in trying to resuscitate the JCPOA only sort of hastened this. There was some hope that with the Biden administration and the idea that they would hit the ground running, they might be able to get the JCPOA back online before these June elections. That has not happened. Even before Raisi's announcement, it was very clearly predicted a conservative would be winning in June. What the Guardian Council has done is just ensure very much so that this is a lockup for him particularly, but generally for a conservative.
What's the impact of sanctions on daily life? How severe are they?
Oh, phenomenally severe. People don't have jobs, and yet they need to subsist. Very often, pricing for manufactured goods is in dollars. I'll give you an example. Last time I was in Iran and I was in a grocery store, I saw a box of, I think it was muesli from Switzerland. It was $12. I don't even think it costs $12 in Switzerland. And think that somebody who makes $2 a day, they may not be trying to buy that. That is for sure a luxury good. But let's think then you're sick. The implications of medicine, some of the basic raw resources are not made or indigenous to Iran, even though Iran has a very good pharmaceutical industry. Much of the raw resources come from outside. Cancer medication in particular. And there have been, in recent years, increasing rates of cancer amongst Iranians in Iran. And so your basic necessities, the government is talking about removing subsidies on bread. Over 30% of the Iranian population, by official numbers, is under the poverty line. It's quite dramatic, the impact of sanctions on Iran and daily life.
It seems like the hardliners in both Washington and Iran are quite pleased by sanctions and the enmity and difficulties they create. It seems to consolidate both sides' political power. There's no incentive to depart from this, is there?
I'm going to take that in two questions. So it absolutely reaffirms the hardline positions. Sanctions are a success. And it determines on what your goals are, but sanctions were initially and continue to be proffered as a tool to bring the alleged offending party to the negotiating table and or make them change their behavior. So if you operate on those two pillars of what it is to impose sanctions, then sanctions are a failure here against Iran, and they have been a failure. The Trump policy was they claimed it to be a success because they decimated the Iranian economy. It's not the explicit point of sanctions, right? They very quickly got to the underbelly of why it is an alleged offending party renegotiates or comes to the negotiating table, as they have been forced to do so. The Trump administration looked around and said, well, sanctions have not worked against Iran because we and the international community have never agreed upon at one time the forceful use of sanctions, except under Obama. And so let us use the United States' financial power and hegemony over the entirety of the financial system. And this is the way we'll use sanctions effectively and bring Iran in. And so because all of the financial system runs through the United States, this is how it worked. So anyone doing business in the U.S., anyone who has a subsidiary in the U.S., which is everybody, was subject to sanctions. And the counter, part of the rise, I think you have talked a good bit about cryptocurrencies. Part of the response to those has been mining for Bitcoin and the fact that Iran actually then developed an internal cryptocurrency program, which had been banned. And we'll start seeing an increase in bartering. Again, back to China and Iran. The reason you don't have all the numbers on the ledger is that there's a bartering system, and both governments have turned to alternative means of payment methods, particularly inside their borders.
Okay, so this election is likely to yield a conservative government. You have a population that is suffering and angry and alienated. What will the political repercussions be in the coming months after these elections?
I don't expect to see too many repercussions about this. And part of the story, a huge part of the story, I think that's being missed about these elections is the why. I was telling you earlier, I'm in DC. Part of being in DC is sometimes who you run into, and not far, actually across the way from me, is the former director of policy and planning. And I saw him this morning, and he came up to me and was like, Nita, what is going on with these elections? I don't understand. And I was like, what do you mean? And he was like, well, why? Why are the Iranians doing this? Why is this? There has to be a why. You can't just constantly report about what is transpiring and miss the pivotal question, and that is the why. And I said, well, there's a transition coming. And he was like, nobody's written anything about this. And I was like, well, I can't speak for anybody else. I've been busy. So the why, before I get to the ramifications of it, is that there is, I think, a transition underway. A number of people have talked about Raisi as the possible next leader, even though Khamenei sounds pretty healthy when you listen to him. He is 81 years old. Being president is in many ways sort of the next step down in terms of public executive leadership positions. It will be 8 years. The history shows Iranian presidents tend to get reelected. So it will be an 8-year measure, if it's uninterrupted, where Raisi shows his ability to manage a very complicated bureaucratic system domestically and do a foreign policy. It will bring him in closer contact with Khamenei. It will bring him in closer contact with the levers of power. He is already supported by the Revolutionary Guard. And so this is the why, is that there is a transition coming. And the Guardian Council, even though Larijani's brother was very upset about his being removed from the list, there is clearly the desire for a smooth power transition when it's necessary. And because of this 8-year sort of history, Raisi, if he is to be the next supreme leader, which people are saying is the case, he needs to become president now, not in 4 years or later.
Well, the current supreme leader will be 89, right? In 8 years.
Yes, yes. Even if you assume that Khamenei lives for the next 8 years, he will be 89 years old. And so the idea is, it is best, and for people who have studied sort of the history of Khamenei and his rise to power, he came with a group of people. Let us not forget that he was with Rafsanjani. They were sort of cohorts. There was a group of colleagues around Khamenei when he first started, and he has slowly worked tactically and strategically, obviously, to get to this position where there is no, I mean, some of it is he's outlived them, but the other part of it is that he is now by himself, literally and figuratively, in the power political spectrum. And so they're testing the ground for, let's say, Raisi. And so this the presidency gives him 8 years for others to assess, for others to help guide him, and others to teach him, despite the fact that he is 60 years old. There are some questions about his leadership and how good of a job he's done running the judiciary and sort of the allegations of corruption, right? So the presidency gives him this very large role and public role to test the waters.
It's not every country where the presidency has auditions for a higher office.
Exactly. But they, there is clearly the desire for an audition. And even if it is a done deal, it is the mechanism for a smooth transition. And it also, so in addition to sort of this very much larger positioning, the conservatives are saying, despite the appearance of instability, or maybe some actual instability, they are actually firmly in control, right? If the idea is instability or the appearance of instability is opportunity, an opportunity for troublemakers and any sort of category that you want to put under there, this is saying that they feel that they have matters under control and they can so break from the accepted practices of republicanism as they exist in Iran that they can do this. And that's what it's saying. Usually we sort of see, and there's this interpretation that these kind of like power grabs are reflective of insecurity. I would sort of say that the conservatives behind this move feel so secure about where they, and so back coming full back to your question, Doug, I have not forgotten it. Because of these two things, and particularly this last part about what I'm saying, I don't think that there will be a short-term impact from the Iranian population, right? If you are expecting riots or protests or anything along these lines, when Raisi gets inaugurated in August, no, I don't think so. I think this whole process is the conservatives saying that they are in control. And even if they're not fully in control, they're taking control. And all of that serves to set up for transition of power, because something might happen in the next 8 years. But more importantly, it will give and elevate Raisi, again, if he is selected, that elevated stature going into the supreme leader position.
That was Neda Bolucci, an assistant professor of Middle Eastern Studies at Rutgers. That's it from me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, another freshly released component of the Kill Rockstars 30th anniversary compilation. This is a cover of Deer Hoofs, The Tears and Music of Love, done by Shaley, featuring Kinwin Sterling. Till next week, bye.